Angeles Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this issue of PTR, we take a look at the topic of corporate crime. We do this from a slightly different perspective as we get an analysis of what our guest, author David Simon, calls elite deviance.
Corporate crooks are very different than individual crooks. Can you imagine a serial killer or any other kind of mass murderer getting to call a news conference and rationalize why they committed multiple murders? Or a bank robber getting to call a news conference? Corporate crooks are qualitatively different than any other type of criminal. They can literally attempt to change the definition of reality, literally attempt to throw off the deviant label. No other kind of crook gets to do that. No other kind of crook gets to testify before Congress, gets to have dinner at the White House. Bill Gates, 3 weeks after the antitrust suit was filed against his company, was having dinner with Bill Clinton at the White House.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. The Enron scandal grabbed the nation's attention as it rocked the political and economic boat. And once again, the issue of so-called white-collar crime is in the public consciousness. But when we address issues like Enron and others, are we talking about simple criminality? Or are we talking about something deeper, something more pathological? Our guest is author David Simon. Our California Bay Area correspondent Steve Miller speaks with Simon about his book on the topic, Elite Deviance.
David, exactly what is white-collar crime, and does it deserve to be called that, or is elite deviance a better name for it?
Well, that's a good question. The definition of crime is still hotly debated in criminology, and the definition of white-collar crime is even more hotly debated. I call my book Elite Deviance because I believe that the concept of crime is not inclusive enough. I use deviance as a basic concept because deviance includes both acts that are against the law and acts that are harmful but not against the law. I believe that there are many things that take place that kill people, that deprive them of their money, that make the general public distrust elites, both in government and in corporate America, that are not against the law, but nevertheless contribute to the general atmosphere of harm and distrust in America. And that's why I call the book Elite Deviance.
So in a broader sense, we're talking about crimes like toxic dumping.
The actions of tobacco companies and liquor companies in evading responsibility for the harm that comes from the products they sell. And I'm not the only one who feels this way. Interestingly enough, the U.S. Department of Justice White Collar Crime Research Center, of which I am a part, had a 3-day definitional conference about white collar crime. And we did end up including in our definition this other aspect of harm and broaden the definition to include non-criminal acts as well.
So if we're looking at this, what is the scope of white-collar crime or elite deviance, and what are some of the results that we see?
Well, the scope is immense because it's global. It includes the actions of multinational corporations that take products that have been banned for sale here in the United States by law and take those products overseas and sell them. They take toxic waste that they can't dump here legally and dump that overseas. They bribe foreign governments. There's actions by our government that take place on a global scale. The government of our own country is the biggest polluter in the United States. Not many people know that. Much of its pollution is classified because it takes place on military reservations. There's a whole additional host of actions, both criminal and non-criminal, when you talk about the scope of this thing. It includes everything from antitrust violations, price fixing, fraud, violation of advertising laws, violation of ecological laws by corporations, all the way to breaking laws by government, which include electioneering, violations of civil rights, things like racial profiling that we've heard so much about recently, bribery, and defense contracting violations, and as well as violations of human rights around the world.
So if we include these categories as elite deviants, then this form of crime is really much greater than what normally is considered crime, which is just individual one-on-one crimes.
Yeah. Well, no matter how you measure this, elite deviance is more serious than all other types of crime, plus the cost of running the criminal justice system. The latest estimate on white-collar crime has been set at $1.1 trillion. Compare that to so-called street crime by people who commit robbery and burglary and so on, which is usually set at $10 billion. Or another way that people measure the seriousness of crime is by the number of lives lost. The homicide rate in the United States is usually set at about 20 to 25,000 murders a year. White-collar deviance, if you want to call it that, or elite deviance, usually is estimated at three times as many lives lost than is lost to homicide. So, and that's a very conservative estimate. That doesn't include the number of people killed by cigarette smoking, doesn't include the number of people that are killed and alcohol-related deaths and so on.
I gather then that the people who are the elite, I mean, we're talking about Enron and
yes.
the not just the Bush administration, but both parties and
yes.
and the Clinton administration also. These people try to have a very vague and amorphous concept of what elite deviance is, but they're very specific. They almost have an official ideology of what crime is that points the finger in the other direction.
Well, it's very interesting. Part of elite deviance is the ideology of the crime problem itself and what types of crime are serious and who the real criminals are. And the mass media and politicians do everything they can to keep the center of attention focused on those criminals that are down at the bottom of society, the so-called street criminals or violent criminals. And there's two things that need to be said about that I think are very important. One is that having the attention focused at those criminals that are lower class criminals or violent criminals takes the attention away from these elite criminals, the Enrons and the corporations that pollute the environment and so on and so forth, that cost many more lives and much more money. And the second thing is, and not many people appreciate this, all these types of crime are intimately interrelated in many, many ways, and that you can't separate the violence that goes on at the bottom of society from the kinds of money laundering and drug trafficking and so on and so forth that takes place and reaches the very top of society. These are inseparable, and to make these kinds of false distinctions only serves those people in power who get away with their acts.
One difference between elite deviance and individual crime is that we have organizational complicity here, where you have Arthur Andersen's firm complicit with people in the government, complicit with Enron.
Yeah.
And so does this then really create the overall organization of crime in society? Are we getting trickle-down crime?
Well, it's part of it. But it's not the full picture. It's part of the forest, but it's just some of the trees. There are other organizations that contribute to this as well. There are global crime syndicates like the ones that are presented on The Sopranos every week for the public to watch. They're organizational in nature too, but they're not the same organizations. But they have contact with each other. And I think that this is another thing the public doesn't appreciate. You cannot have organized crime syndicates without legitimate elites to launder their money, to look the other way when they commit their deviant acts, and so on and so forth. This is all of a big piece. It's like a huge department store where the people in the department store have specialized functions that exist on different floors of the department store. They don't know each other, but they have interrelationships with each other. It's a very interesting phenomenon. The CIA, for instance, has been involved in drug trafficking for 50 years.
Right.
And they've helped establish every one of the major drug trafficking routes into the United States for the last five decades. Yet, not everybody in the CIA knows every major drug trafficker in the world, nor do they engage in drug trafficking themselves, people in the CIA. Yet, these interconnections exist. The same with illegal arms dealing. People in organized crime engage in illegal arms dealing, and sometimes they have deals with the CIA. It's a very interesting phenomenon. And these interconnections are vital at times to people in the CIA and so on. Back in the 60s, the CIA hired organized crime to try and assassinate Fidel Castro. It doesn't hire organized crime every week to try and bump off some leader in a foreign country, but from time to time it does undertake to hire them for their services, and that these links exist.
We're here with David Simon, the author of Elite Deviance, about white-collar crime in America. So in a way, the street crime of somebody who is needs their next fix or somebody who's desperate for money is, in a certain sense, is using the services provided by the drug dealers,
exactly.
Who then are using the services provided by the people who are really organizing the whole thing.
And certainly the people in the CIA don't know people who are street addicts and who take drugs by name. But yet this weird set of interconnections exist. And there's no denying that. We've known that for several decades now.
Does the ultimate end of elite deviance wind up perpetuating even a greater polarization of wealth and power into the hands of the elite?
Absolutely. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer because of this system for a number of reasons. The organization of corporate America is that of oligopolies. The studies that we have say that the oligopolistic structure of the key industries in this country, the automobile industry, the oil industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and other key industries, increase the cost of living by as much as 25% in this country. The studies we have of the distribution of wealth indicate that 90% of the privately held wealth in this country is owned by 10% of the population. That makes for a situation where the rich continue to get richer because they have the greatest influence over tax policy and over the way federal subsidies are distributed and so on. That keeps distributing wealth upward and it keeps making the poor poorer. The people on the bottom of society tend to be the first fired and the last hired when it comes to labor policy. They're the ones that suffer the most during recessions like these. They are the ones who populations are found in our prisons. They disproportionately are the ones who get put to death in capital punishment cases. They are the ones who are most powerless when it comes to social scientists studying them, and they have the worst representation when it comes to going into a court of law. They also get the worst medical care, and they suffer the most stress-related diseases.
It's clear that there are plenty of corporate crimes. They become public every once in a while. But do you think that a corporation in and of itself, in the sense that it provides an environment, does this contribute to elite deviance and corporate crime?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of writing. Some of it is in my own book about how there are sets of institutionalized deviant practices that go on in certain industries where certain corporate crimes become almost customs, especially in automobiles, in petrochemicals, and in pharmaceuticals, where these industries have over and over again practiced certain criminal acts, and they continue to do so. If you look at the least trusted occupations in this country, over and over again, car dealers show up. There's a reason for that. And oil companies tend to show up, energy companies. In Enron cases, it's sort of the tip of the iceberg in that regard. And so, yeah, there are these so-called crimogenic industries, which have a long tradition of criminal behavior. If you look at the rap sheets of certain corporations in these industries, like General Electric, you'll see criminal behavior going back all the way to the 1950s.
You mention in your book that there's a certain modus operandi that elite deviance enjoys employing, and that's the creation of crisis.
The whole issue is whether the crisis is genuine or not. And if it's a phony crisis that's used to gouge the public out of its money or take political advantage in some way, then that's a deviant situation. The most recent one of these has probably been California's energy crisis, where everybody ran around for a while yelling, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And now all of a sudden, as almost as quickly as it started, it seems to be over with. The public is very much the poorer for it. It's a very strange situation. And we never seem to reach the point where we develop these so-called alternative energy sources, no matter how much people seem to want them. And we always seem to be in an education crisis of some kind. And the answer to the crisis always seems to somehow be money. And unless you're someone from a wealthy school system, and then politicians whose children are in those systems seem to stand up and say, money's really not the answer. And this is what they tell poor people who don't have much money spent on their school systems. And this is another thing that continually perplexes me. Only people from school systems whose children have many resources spent on them tell poor people that, no, money's not the answer.
Do you see in the post-September 11th period, do you see elements of elite deviance going on?
Yeah. One of the things that I'm most fearful of is what Jonathan Quitney called in his book, The Creation of Endless Enemies. You have a situation where the Al-Qaeda network is supposedly in 50 or 60 countries. And given that, I think for those who want to see the United States create endless enemies where it can go on fighting for an indeterminate length of time, the great question in all this is going to be, how much is enough? The question is always going to be, how much is enough? The answer, I suppose, is going to be, if there's another terrorist attack on American soil or another in Israel that's bad enough or somewhere in Europe, it's going to always be used as an excuse to go into another country and send U.S. fighting men and women into a dangerous situation, and also to increase the defense budget. If you look at what George Bush is doing, it's this very same set of tactics that Ronald Reagan used when he was president. You cut tactics, increase the defense budget, increase the deficit, and say that you can do all these things and still somehow balance it all out in the end. And it didn't work in the 80s, and it's not going to work now.
One of the standard things that we're told these days is that after September the 11th, the individual rights will have to be sacrificed for public safety.
Right.
Do we see the same effort to put controls on corporate rights or any of the other forms of power elitism that we see in this country?
No, because the corporations never complain about the fact that racial profiling might be used or individual rights of habeas corpus or related constitutional guarantees might somehow be abridged. The defense budget's been bloated again. And the corporations who engage in defense contracting, and I'm not talking here just about corporations that make weapon systems, but you wouldn't believe some of the corporations who contract with the Defense Department. Pharmaceutical companies, oil companies who sell gas and oil and jet fuel and so on, they're all on the list of top 100 biggest defense contractors too. Companies that supply food, companies that supply a myriad of other things, do business with the Defense Department. They, I think, are all standing up and applauding all this.
How does the corporate and the political elite that are really committing these deviant acts, how do they justify their crimes to the public?
Most of the time, they don't. These are the things that very often are classified as secret or top secret, not found out for years. In the Enron case, let's say, if you just take this one as an example, first thing they do is engage in what's called the neutralization of deviance. They deny that they did anything wrong. Second thing they do is they push the guilt outward on any of their subcontractors or their accomplices. You know, it was Arthur Anderson's fault. They're the ones who shredded the documents. And we told them not to do it, but they did it anyway. The third thing they do is they blame it on some error that they made. We did it, but we didn't mean to do it. Every study of corporate crime that's ever been done shows that they meant to do it. Corporate crooks are very different than individual crooks. Can you imagine a serial killer or any other kind of mass murderer getting to call a news conference and rationalize why they committed multiple murders, or a bank robber getting to call a news conference? Corporate crooks are qualitatively different than any other type of criminal. They can literally attempt to change the definition of reality, literally attempt to throw off the deviant label. No other kind of crook gets to do that. No other kind of crook gets to testify before Congress, gets to have dinner at the White House. Bill Gates, 3 weeks after the antitrust suit was filed against his company, was having dinner with Bill Clinton at the White House. I mean, how many other criminals get to do that? It's insane.
One of the points you make in your book is that there are only a few historical junctures where the real issues of morality and immorality get placed in relationship to law. Explain how the Nuremberg trials really had that, was one of those junctures.
Oh, you mean the Bayer Aspirin people? Oh, yeah. What they tried to do, this was Bayer Aspirin's parent company. They went to the Nazis and they bought a bunch of concentration camp inmates to help build a synthetic gasoline plant and a synthetic rubber plant. And the problem was that they worked these people to death, and they ill-treated them so badly that they couldn't even survive the trip back and forth to the site where they were supposed to build these plants. And so they decided to go back to the Nazis and say, look, we'll build our own concentration camp next to the site where we want to build these plants. They can't even stand to march back and forth to the site from your lousy concentration camp. So the Nazis said, all right. Then the Bayer people got this bright idea that since all these people were replaceable, they would minimally feed them, minimally care for them medically, and minimally house them, because if they died, they knew they could replace them very easily. So they started to build these barracks for them right next to the sites where they wanted to build these synthetic plants. And the fact is that 25,000 people, slave laborers, died trying to build these synthetic gasoline and synthetic rubber plants, and not one drop of rubber, one drop of gasoline was ever produced. And the people from IG Farben were placed on trial, the Nuremberg trials, and they were convicted for engaging in slave labor employment after the war. And they were not supposed to serve on the board of IG Farben ever again, although they did. Some of them came back and did serve on the board. Even more telling was Hannah Arendt's book about Eichmann. What they found was this mild-mannered bureaucrat who didn't hate the Jews, did exactly what he was told by his captors, and when he went on trial, gave as his defense as to why he carried out all the orders to kill the Jews, was that it was merely his job. He was merely following orders. And much of elite deviance is like that. It's just daily life. It's just routine events. Arendt called it the banality of evil. And that's what bureaucracies can do, because they're amoral institutions. And that's what makes them so confounding. If they were totally immoral, they would be much easier to become outraged about. And if they were totally moral, we would have a little to talk about here because we'd all love them. But being amoral, they're like loose cannons. They can do very great deeds or they can do terrible harms. And that's what we see, both in government and in corporate America.
You write that the very nature of immorality has changed. What were you trying to get at with this?
Daily life can all of a sudden turn from just a routine doing of something that's quite moral into a terrible evil. Dow Chemical can be making bathroom cleaner one day and napalm that's used to bomb innocent civilians the next.
With Enron, a lot of people compare it to the Teapot Dome scandal, but this is really at a higher level.
Yeah. The Teapot Dome scandal was about good old-fashioned graft. A secretary of the Interior was bribed in order that an oil company be allowed to dig for oil on public land. The Enron scandal involved bribery at the highest levels of government, and more than one corporation is involved.
Right? Most societies sooner or later consolidate around certain values that they stand for as a society. But do we see the elite taking these values and twisting them into something different than what they originally were?
No, I think we see these values being taken to an extreme. And as some people have written, what makes civilizations decline is when their initial values are taken to great extremes and held too tightly. And that's what I see happening here in America. And the extremes, those values which are being taken to an extreme, I think are making a fetish out of money, individualism, which has become narcissism, and competition, which has become cutthroat and destructive competition. Those have contributed to a tremendous amount of fraud and deception and manipulation in American life.
David Simon, author of the book Elite Deviance, speaking with PTR's California Bay Area correspondent, Steve Miller. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same tools of electronics and robotics that are being used to displace millions of workers around the world are used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League or our other print or audio materials, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888, 1-800-691-6888, or visit us on the web at www.lrna.org. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.